For northern Scotland, generally quite a cloudy day with outbreaks of rain and drizzle with highs of 14 or 15 Celsius. On Wednesday, Scotland and Northern Ireland stay generally dry and bright with some sunny spells with temperatures in the teens. England and Wales could well be the hottest day of the week with temperatures in the mid to high 20s. But as I said, that could then spark some thunderstorms. That's the forecast.
Alex, thank you. Now on Radio 4, we begin a new Book of the Week, Alexandria. In the new year of 2011, on the eve of the Arab Spring, the writer and journalist Peter Stothard was in Egypt's second city, Alexandria, to complete a book about Cleopatra. With him were the remains of seven previous attempts. This time, he was determined to finish it. Alexandria by Peter Stothard is read by Kenneth Cranham.
Hotel Metropole, Place Saad Saghloul, Alexandria. This is precisely the eighth time I've begun to write this book. I'm certain of that. It sometimes seems the only certainty. Here in room 114 of the Metropole Hotel, there is written evidence of all the other seven attempts. Long pages and short scraps, bleached and yellowed, each piece patchworking into the bed cover as though they'd always been here. I have unpacked them as carefully as though they were ancient history itself. More carefully than I packed them in London yesterday. There is no order yet. The first are not even my own words, they are Morris's. I've not read them for 40 years, not since we were at Oxford together and I first followed his florid dictation. His story of the Red Tents was part of my fifth Cleopatra, perhaps one of the less respectable attempts, the mingling of geometry, classics and pornography. It was a shock at the time. I was easier to shock back then. But I recorded it in clear, round lettering in a college room at Trinity as accurately as the fumes of sherry and old spice allowed. Morris was my oldest friend. We shared little in common, he the smooth one, I the rough, he the pale-faced, I the freckled, he the teller of jokes and tales, I the listener. We shared primary and secondary schools, children's parties and sports fields, college rooms and student stages. We also, for a short while, shared a passion for a dead queen of Egypt. My hotel bed is becoming crowded. The papers do not form easy categories or files. Each lies flat and alone. Tonight, on the eve of this new decade, the eve of the year in which I will be 60 years old, every remnant of my past Cleopatras is a different patch, in a fraying quilt, on a bed, beside an iron balcony, before a view over the bay where her palaces, ships and libraries used to be. From the year 1960, when Morris and I were 9 years old, only a book title survives: Professor Rame and the Egyptian Queen. The earliest pages are from around 1963. Sellotaped in yellow stripes, an account which began with naive confidence at Cleopatra's birth, in a room not far from this hotel, and with her father, King Ptolemy XII, known to obedient subjects as Dionysus the Drunkard God, and to the disobedient majority as Old Flute Player, the Drunkard Musician. Most of my surviving words are handwritten. Only a few of the later parts are typed. Many other pages were lost entirely, left in desk drawers of abandoned jobs and buildings, but that hardly matters. This book is not going to be a reconstruction. It is a new start, and this time there will be an end. This time there's also an instruction from the Queen herself, a signed order. The only surviving autograph from any classical figure whose life story has flourished beyond life. This document was unknown in 1985, when the last page was closed on my seventh Cleopatra. It was found at the turn of the new millennium among Roman office papers reused for stuffing mummies. Cleopatra's single word, her last word as I intend to see it, written in her own first language in Greek, in neat, small, upward-sloping letters. Ginestho. Let it be done. Do as I command. Make it happen. The Ginestho papyrus is of no special kind. The ink is dull. The order is securely dated, like any proper product of a well-run office. The date is February 33 BC, as we now designate our months and years, the prelude to the most dramatic time in even as dramatic a life as Cleopatra's. The order, dictated to a secretary and presented in a fair copy for signature, is that one of her most loyal protectors should be freed from certain taxes. She takes up a pen at a 45-degree angle, routinely, relaxedly, running the last four letters together in a single fluid stroke, and writes the Ginestho on the decree that Mark Antony's general, Publius Canidius Crassus, and his heirs, in perpetuity, may export each year from Egypt 300 tons of wheat and import 130,000 litres of wine without paying tax to her or to her children. This is a tax exemption for the far future from the Egyptian head of a great Greek family who has entered Rome's civil wars. World wars then, with every intention of being on the winner's side. Her man, Canidius, commands the greatest army of the time. She herself commands the most massive personal treasury. The odds are that her lover, Mark Antony, will soon defeat his rival, Octavian, for the leadership of the Roman world. The legacy of her earlier lover, the assassinated Julius Caesar. She may even choose to exert that leadership not from Rome, but from her own palace here, where tonight the cars honk ceaselessly in the square, the birds and beggars scratch on the beach, and the Nile waters still mingle, more sluggishly now, with the Mediterranean Sea. "Make it happen," she wrote. Her word went out into corridors of bureaucrats and bandits, corruptors and corrupted. Cleopatra's people were bureaucratic pioneers, masters of the catalogue and file, inventive manipulators of myth. Although Cleopatra signed orders for music and poetry, wars and executions, medical experiments and monumental theatre, exempting a man from taxes was in no way a smaller matter than these. Revenue made things happen, or stopped things happening. Of course, this Ginestho soon became an unnecessary concession. Within 2 years, Cleopatra was dead. The Romans took all Egypt for themselves. Her promise had become a bribe that she need not have made. A few words on a fragile piece of papyrus, a part of the rubbish used to fill the space between a body and a coffin. For the next 2,000 years, it would cushion an unidentified cranium against a painted piece of wood, a lesson in recycling from an age resourceful in the arts of reuse. Only in the last 10 years has it become a thing of resonance once again, one of those rarest of objects, a direct connection between a great queen and those of us who have so long tried to make her our subject. After a short walk around the square, I'm back in room 114 with the latest news that for most Alexandrians is no longer new. Indeed, I must be one of the very last people in this city to know that persons unknown, at least one of them no longer knowing, breathing or anything, have marked the arrival of 1111 on their electronic watches with a bomb, detonated 30 minutes after midnight, a mile or so away, outside a crowded church. It was Mahmoud, a young man from here at the Metropole Hotel, who told me. He spoke with minimal opening of his mouth. There was nothing to worry about. Everywhere in the world, there were suicidists. The media should not make so much of 23 deaths that happened to have happened in Egypt. He had an older, unshaven, workman-trousered colleague who mildly disagreed. Socrates was from the Cecil, the rival colonial refuge on the seaside of the square. He was more relaxed, but gave a sharper warning. Today, he said, might not be the best day to visit Pompey's Pillar or the library. Even in the early hours, there was agitation, alarm, and the police are checking papers. This Socrates seemed the senior of these gentle quarrellers. I first noticed them when I arrived last night. They were waiting like bored cab drivers beside bags of horse feed beneath my window. In the dark, I did not ask myself or anyone else who they were or why they seemed relieved to see me. In the dirty morning light, I was more curious. Our brief conversation about the bomb did not provide many answers. "Why are you here?" asked Socrates. "Nothing comes to Alexandria in the winter except birds to the lake, most of them when they have lost their way." I explained my business, and we kept on talking. He, too, was a man of business, he claimed. "Bombing is very bad for all business." I sympathized. "Old Zagu is not getting any visitors at all," he hissed, pointing to the police, who waved away anyone approaching the giant striding statue that separates the hotels in this square that bears his name. I nodded. I was still finding my way. "Who was old Zagu?" I asked. Mahmud looked impatiently towards the sea. Socrates answered, but grumpily, like a speaking guidebook. "A very modern Egyptian, a father of our country, a hero who in 1924 has survived many years in prison, but only a single year as Prime Minister. He was one of those who thought wrongly that he could do business with the British occupiers of Egypt, while the British thought, just as wrongly, that they could do business with him. Yet all the time," said Socrates, "things were going on that first gave us Colonel Nasser, and now something much, much the same." Maybe Socrates is a professional guide with one or two unofficial opinions. Mahmud may perhaps be a guide too, even though he has the complexion of an office dweller rather than a man of the outdoors. Perhaps he's an organizer of guides, shrinking back nervously from the restless, blinkered horses. Or perhaps he's not frightened of the horses, but of something else. "Careful, careful," Mahmud whispered to both of us with warmth and a threat. "Zagul, Nasser, Mubarak, all of them good men." Socrates, unmoved and mud-eyed, suggested that we all meet later in a place he called my café. 24 hours ago, I left London unexpectedly, and no one I know will see me here. I could have fixed to see writers or politicians or critics, the contributors to the newspaper that I edit. I might have brought crisp, clean clothes and a laptop computer. Instead, I'm wearing frayed jeans, scuffed suede shoes, and I'm pushing out words on a notepad. This is not how it was supposed to be. For the last weeks of my 59th year, I had a suitcase packed for a different trip, to the winter sunshine 5,000 miles to the south. But Christmas was frozen, the London airports were iced for many days, and when the ice melted, there were far too many travellers for South Africa and not enough planes. Egypt was an easier ticket to buy, from Hampstead to Cairo, to the fluorescent checkpoints of the desert and the Metropole Hotel, to a tiny, tall room with a balcony overlooking the sea.
Kenneth Cranham was reading the first extract from Alexandria, The Last Nights of Cleopatra, by Peter Stothard. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Where the shipping forecast follows sailing by.